again, everyone. This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the co-director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's. And I'm joined once again by my friend and colleague, Mark DiGirolami, the center's co-director, for another episode of Legal Spirits, our podcast series on cases and issues in law and religion. You can find past episodes archived at our website, lawandreligionforum.org, and also on Apple iTunes. Well, since our last podcast in December, the court has been very busy, and so we have some catching up to do. And today we're going to speak about a case on which the court granted cert in December, actually a pair of consolidated cases on the so-called ministerial exception. And the cases are Our Lady of Guadalupe School versus Morrissey Beru and St. James School versus Beale. Now, under the ministerial exception, churches and religious organizations, for example, schools, are immune from employment discrimination suits with respect to ministers. The basic idea is that civil government, including the courts, cannot interfere with a church's decision with respect to hiring, firing, or disciplining its leaders and the people it relies on to carry its message to the public. Such interference would violate both the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. Well, these new cases will require the court to revisit the landmark case of Hosanna Tabor from 2012, in which the court first said that the ministerial exception is constitutionally required under both religion clauses. Specifically, these new cases will require the court to clarify the definition of minister, on which the whole exception turns, obviously. How do we know whether a church employee is a minister such that the exception applies? Well, Hosanna Tabor employed a multi-factor totality of the circumstances test for defining minister. The court said we have to look to the employee's title, to whether the employee is holding himself or herself out as a minister, to the employee's religious training and credentialing, and the employee's function. But how do all these factors work? Must all of them be present for someone to be a minister? Is one factor, for example, function, more important than the others? The Hosanna Tabor Court left these questions open. So in this podcast, we're going to give some background on Hosanna Tabor, on the ministerial exception and the definition of ministers, and then we'll describe the cases that the court has just granted and the question that they raise. Finally, we'll highlight some issues the court will need to consider as it clarifies its earlier decision. In my view anyway, and Mark, we can talk about this, the question of who qualifies as a minister is likely to be determined not by abstract or conceptual inquiries, but by the justice's sense of the values that the ministerial exception is meant to promote, and indeed the justice's sense of the benevolence of churches and religious institutions in American life. Okay, so let's start there, Mark. Why don't you give us some background on the ministerial exception and the Hosanna Tabor case?
Okay, great. So the ministerial exception is a court-created doctrine and court-embraced as of 2012, Supreme Court-embraced as of 2012. And the doctrine recognizes an exception to anti-discrimination laws, you know, laws that bar discrimination suits, which would ordinarily be brought by people who are aggrieved for various purposes, whether that's discrimination on the basis of race or sex or age or disability. Well, those suits, under certain circumstances, are prevented, are barred by this doctrine, when the suits are brought against churches and religious organizations with respect to hiring, firing, and disciplining employees who are or are determined to be ministers. And as I say, in this important case, Hosanna Tabor, a 2012 case, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that the exception is constitutionally required under both the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause.
And Mark, what was the court's reasoning in that case? Why did the court say that there is this so-called ministerial exception?
So the key language from the case is as follows. The court said, quote, "The members of a religious group put their faith in the hands of their ministers. Requiring a church to accept or retain an unwanted minister or punishing a church for failing to do so intrudes upon more than a mere employment decision. Such action interferes with the internal governance of the church, depriving the church of control over the selection of those who will personify its beliefs. By imposing an unwanted minister, the state infringes the Free Exercise Clause, which protects a religious group's right to shape its own faith and mission through its appointments. According to the state, the power to determine which individuals will minister to the faithful also violates the Establishment Clause, which prohibits government involvement in such ecclesiastical decisions, close quote. So that's really the kind of crux of what the court held, that both doctrines are implicated. And I should mention that subsequent to Hosanna Tabor, there's been an extensive literature about just exactly which clause is doing the work. Is it really both clauses? Is it more the Free Exercise or the Establishment Clause, and so on?
Well, maybe the court will clarify some of that in this new case too. Now, the important thing to note, of course, is that this exception doesn't apply to all church employees, only to ministers. Well, so who's a minister? In Hosanna Tabor, the court held that a teacher at a Lutheran school qualified as a minister, but the court declined to adopt a rigid formula for determining when an employee was a minister. Instead, the court indicated that one should look to the totality of the circumstances. And the court in Hosanna Tabor concluded that four circumstances that were present in that case led to the conclusion that the teacher was a minister, namely her formal title, the substance of her title, that is, her religious training and credentialing, her own use of the title, and finally, her duties, her role, again to quote the court, her role in conveying the church's message and carrying out its mission.
Right. And just with respect to the issue of her own use of the title, that's not just a sort of a formal question about whether she goes by, puts a number of letters after her name and so on. It's about how he or she understands his or her role. And that lots of different sorts of evidence can come in to prove exactly how the person understands, takes themselves to be acting within the religious organization.
Okay, that's a useful clarification. Now in Hosanna Tabor, the employee's title was commissioned minister. That's her title, commissioned minister. She had significant religious training and credentialing. She referred to herself as a minister, for example, on her tax returns. And finally, she taught students in religion. And she led them in prayer, and she occasionally accompanied them to she actually always accompanied them to student worship services, but she even led the students in worship services sometimes. Now, the court expressly declined to say that all factors were necessary for an employee to be a minister. The court left that question open for another day. And so I guess, Mark, now we're coming back to that next case that has to determine more about this.
Yeah, no, and I think this is, in some ways, Hosanna Tabor, that is, was an easy case for the court. Of course, the court was able to tailor the factors exactly to suit the case itself, and thereafter found that all the factors were satisfied, and that this was an easy, a good vehicle by which to decide on the first time that it was deciding that this ministerial exception exists. But as you say, the court didn't opine on the question, well, what if all of these factors are not satisfied? What do we do in that situation?
Well, that's probably why the opinion was unanimous. But there were a couple of very interesting concurrences in Hosanna Tabor, right, Mark?
Yes, that's true. So let's talk about two of them. The one concurrence was written by Justice Thomas. And this, I really think, is the broadest take on the court with respect to the scope of the ministerial exception. So Justice Thomas said, look, civil courts should avoid all tests for deciding who is a minister because these tests have the potential to intrude on or influence a church's designation of its leader. So courts instead should defer to a church's good faith, meaning subjectively sincere understanding of who qualifies as a minister. So I think I hope our listeners can see how that's a very deferential, very expansive test with respect to who qualifies. We basically say, hey, if the church thinks you qualify and it is in good faith, it's not trying to sort of pull a fast one or say something sort of semi-ridiculous based on its prior positions, that's going to be sufficient to fall within the ministerial exception.
Right. Almost, complete deference to the church, because frankly, I don't think the court's really going to go behind their declaration. In most cases, I think a court would just accept you're being sincere about this. That was one. And the other concurrence was by Justice Alito, joined by Justice Elena Kagan. And Justice Alito's concurrence suggested that for him, the test really should be purely functional. That is, we shouldn't look to the title, minister, things like that, but rather we should focus on the employee's function in the church. And the ministerial exception, I'm quoting now, should apply to any employee who leads a religious organization, conducts worship services or important religious ceremonies or rituals, or serves as a messenger or teacher of its faith. So for Justice Alito, it all came down to function. What function did this employee play? Was the employee a leader in the church? Was the employee someone who conducted important religious ceremonies? And I think this is probably the most important. Did the employee or does the employee serve as a messenger or teacher of the faith?
Yeah, and I think one can, you're exactly right to call it functionalist. There's something of this already in the existing test that that a majority of the court adopted, right? Where we're just sort of, you know, just to get back to that test, the nature of the duties of the minister and the role of the minister in conveying the church's message and carrying out its mission, right? So that last factor seems like the factor that Justice Alito and joined by Justice Kagan thinks is really the most important, right? You're sort of examining the function, the role of this person and whether they are heavily or substantially involved in religious activities, right, Mark?
Right. Okay, good. So now let's jump ahead to the cases on which the court just granted cert. There are a couple of cases from the Ninth Circuit, all about what is the definition of minister. And the Ninth Circuit actually took a fairly narrow view in these cases. The Ninth Circuit said that, well, the functions that the employee performs, they are never in themselves sufficient to qualify the employee as a minister. Instead, you have to look at these other factors, including, Mark, I think you think probably title of the employee is what matters most.
That's what seems to come through in some of the opinions, at least certainly, and we'll talk a little bit about what some of the judges on the Ninth Circuit say, but it seems to me at least that in these cases, the majority, either panel majority or en banc majorities, is emphasizing and focusing on the specific title held.
Let's talk about these cases, Mark. So let's talk about the St. James School case first.
Great. So St. James School, the defendant is a Catholic school that hired the plaintiff Beal to teach fifth grade. And Beal taught students in all academic subjects, as well as religion class, which occupied a minimum of 200 minutes each week. So she taught according to the Catholic faith. She supervised and participated in the students' daily prayer sessions. And this was all stated in her contract. At some point, she developed breast cancer, after which she received treatment, and she was later fired by the school. So she then sues under the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, for discrimination on the basis of disability. So what happened in that case? The Ninth Circuit ultimately holds that Beal is not a minister for ministerial exception purposes because, unlike Cheryl Parrish, who was the plaintiff in Hosanna Tabor, the school did not hold her out as a minister. She didn't have anything like Parrish's credentials, training, or background, and she did not have the formal title of minister. So it held that the only similarity between these cases was the fact that both these plaintiffs taught religion. So that's basically, it held that the employee has to serve, not only serve a religious function, but also have one or more additional indicia of being a minister.
Yeah, so interesting. We don't think of the Ninth Circuit as a terribly formalist court, but this is certainly a formalist opinion when it comes to who's a minister.
It's a narrow reading. It's a narrow reading of Hosanna Tabor, which focuses especially on the fact, I would say, that she doesn't have any sort of, look, I mean, the most formal criterion here that one could imagine is a title. If they call you minister or you're officially designated a minister, then you are. If you don't, then you aren't.
Right. And this is, and the narrowness of the opinion is what occasioned the long denial, a long dissent from a denial of en banc review.
That's correct. So you had a number of judges on the Ninth Circuit who argued that this reading was an inappropriately narrow reading of Hosanna Tabor, and that the new test, what it called the new test adopted by the Ninth Circuit, wrongly kind of constricted the scope of the ministerial exception. So that's the Beale case.
Great. How about the other one, Our Lady of Guadalupe School?
The other one is the defendant is also a Catholic school under the jurisdiction of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. And the teachers at the school agree by contract to perform all of the functions that they're hired to perform in compliance with Catholic doctrine. And they perform many functions that actually include, in this case, which I think is perhaps somewhat different than the other case, liturgical activities. So the plaintiff in this case, whose name is Morrissey Baru, was a teacher who, in addition to her other obligations, taught daily religion classes, which included doctrinal instruction as well as prayer and devotional instruction. And she led other religious activities for her students. She directed a Passion of Christ play. And then when a new principal came to the school and instituted various new catechetical requirements and certifications, the plaintiff did not obtain those certifications and otherwise didn't comply with the new principal's demands. So she was fired, whereupon she sued for age discrimination under, so we talked about the ADA. This is now the ADEA, which is the federal statute involving or protecting against discrimination on the basis of age. The school won on summary judgment in the district court. Again, the Ninth Circuit reversed, this time in an unpublished opinion and basically adopting the rationale of Beale, the St. James case, in denying this ministerial exception claim as well.
Okay, so those are the two cases. And I mean, I have to say, to jump right to the chase, Mark, I don't know how you feel, but these cases seem pretty easy to me. And I mean, you got to think if the teachers in Catholic schools are responsible for teaching religion and, you know, doing liturgical activities and you know, doctrinal instruction and prayer and leading worship services, it's hard to see how they're not going to be qualified as ministers here. Although, of course, they probably, I'm not sure they would be thought of as ministers in Catholic Church doctrine. I just don't know. But it doesn't seem that hard, does it?
Yeah, no, I think you're probably right about that. I think the Ninth Circuit is likely, of course, one can never say for sure, but likely destined to be reversed on both of these cases. Whether the cases are unanimous or not, as Hosanna Tabor was, is perhaps a closer question.
I agree with that, Mark. And I think actually, so the real interesting thing for us is going to be what test the courts adopt to reach this conclusion. Now, you know, if the schools win, it seems to me that Justice Alito's concurrence in Hosanna Tabor is going to be the reason. That is, the court will adopt the sort of functionalist analysis that Justice Alito did and ask, well, what is the employee actually doing? Is the employee a leader? Is the employee shaping the church's message and inculcating youth in the church's message?
Right. So at the very least, you can count two votes for this position, right? You've got Justice Alito and Justice Kagan who signed on to this very view. I would think Justice Thomas, who espoused an even more deferential view, is probably on board as well. But look, I mean, as we think about an approach that the court might adopt, a new test that is more functionalist, we can analogize both certain strengths and certain weaknesses of a highly functionalist approach to other church, state, or law and religion issues that we've considered on other occasions. So as the test becomes more functionalist, it's going to start encompassing more and more sorts of employment. And you might think of the analogy to cases concerning the definition of religion, what counts mm-hmm. as a religion. As the court and lower courts adopted more functionalist understandings of what religion is, you know, you think of the, you know, military conscription cases in the 1960s, what counts as religion also expanded, or some might say swelled up, from what religion had been before. So the advantage of that approach, of course, is that it's more pluralistic. It's more respectful of different sorts of religions with different understandings about who counts as a minister. A disadvantage is that this can become a kind of unmanageably large category that has no coherence and starts to kind of collapse of its own weight. Not to speak of another kind of disadvantage, which is as the category expands, you are opening yourself up to, you know, attempts by religious organizations or otherwise to kind of shoehorn various sorts of employees who really aren't ministers into that category for purposes of self-protection.
Right. That's a nice point, Mark. So I think what you see here is that a functionalist definition, there are some advantages, but the disadvantages are it can become very vague and perhaps sweep in a lot more than the justices would like to see within this ministerial exception. I think another issue, Mark, another issue I'd like to raise is how this, whatever definition we adopt for minister, for purposes of the ministerial exception, I think it's not going to be informed by formal concepts, you know, an abstract idea of what is a minister or something, because that's just very difficult to figure out. I think what's much more likely is, and as I get older, the older I get, the more I become a realist in these things, that the definition is really epiphenomenal. It's really what we're going to see here is whatever definition the court adopts, it's going to depend on the justice's view about the reasons for the ministerial exception, and even more, whether churches and religion are benevolent or not. I mean, do we think, on the one hand, if you think that, you know, the religious organizations are good for lots of reasons and the state is always kind of out to get them and you have to protect them from this, then you're going to be inclined to have a fairly broad definition of who is a minister and who should qualify for this exception. I think there are some justices on the court who feel that way. On the other hand, if you think, well, these religious organizations really can suppress people and one has to be careful because they treat people unfairly and, you know, the government is needed to step in and protect people who are getting fired because they're sick or because they're members of minorities, whatever, then you're going to have a much narrower view of who is a minister and a much narrower view of the exception. And I think whatever the justices say in these cases, that's going to be behind the scenes. That's really what's going to be motivating these decisions. Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense to me. And by the way, you know, as I go, I sort of see more and more connections and analogies to other issues that we've talked about in various contexts. So another similar kind of issue that I thought about was, what's the definition of a church? You know, does a church include the religious school that is associated with the church? Does a church or church activities include things like religious hospitals, religious universities, and so on? So the extent to which one's definition of church will, as you say, depend upon one's larger view about whether one would very much like to include or exclude other sorts of organizations that one does or does not deem to be socially salutary.
Yeah, and I should say, Mark, I don't mean to say the justices will consciously decide things on the basis
of course.
But these are, you know, there's been a lot of work lately on motivated reasoning in judicial decisions, and I think it must be the case that the judge's prior ideas about whether religion is benevolent or not are going to affect how they look at these cases, because after all, this is a court-made doctrine, the ministerial exception. There's not a lot of text out there you can look at. And by the way, Mark, I want to come back to something we talked about a few weeks ago and you mentioned earlier in the podcast. This is like the definition of religion. You know, should the Satanists count as a religion, yes or no? I mean, they're kind of a satirical group. You know, does that make them a religion or not? So you're right. I think this does tie into other things that we've talked about.
Yeah, no. And I think, you know, all of these questions, I think, implicate similar kinds of problems that we face with respect to the larger question of, I think, exemption too. You know, when we talk about what should be the scope of exemption? Well, you can talk all you want about substantial burden and compelling interest and narrowly tailored, but those categories can often be shaped to reflect whether one thinks religious organizations are doing good in the world. Now, having said all that, I do think that on the narrower question of whether what the Ninth Circuit did was too narrow, that to me seems as we said earlier, a relatively easy question. And I would be surprised, frankly, if not unanimity on the court, that the position that the Ninth Circuit was wrong didn't get a lot of votes.
Yeah, I agree with that too, Mark. Okay, listeners, well, that's it for today. Now, I said the court's been very busy, so we have other podcasts coming. We're going to have to talk about the Espinoza case, going to be argued this month. Then the court just last week granted again a case involving the Little Sisters of the Poor. So they've been busy, and we will be too. But for now, this has been Mark Movsesyan and Mark DiGirolami, the co-directors of the Center for Law and Religion, with another episode of our Legal Spirits podcast series. See you next time.